Hey folks, welcome to episode number 53 of the Next Byte podcast. And in this one, we talk all about how biology meets engineering. We start off by discussing how robots that can be controlled with our minds can really help those that are suffering from spinal cord injuries. And then we hop onto bug robotics. You heard me right, bug robotics. These folks have created small actuators, soft actuators, that can revolutionize the way we think about agriculture and small robotics. So if any of these topics interest you, then buckle up and let's get right into the episode.
I'm Daniel.
And I'm Forbode.
And this is the Next Byte podcast. Every week, we explore interesting and impactful tech and engineering content from Weevolver.com and deliver it to you in bite-sized episodes that are easy to understand, regardless of your background.
All right, everyone, let's get started with this episode. It's all about biomimicry. It's like biology meeting engineering. And the first article is about how our mind is interfacing with technology. So before we get started, I want to give a quick shout out to Mouser Electronics. If you're not aware, Mouser Electronics is one of the biggest electronics distributors in the world. And they also write a lot of interesting articles about emerging technologies. One of these is like this overview of brain-computer interfaces. It's written by our friend Paul. If you're like interested in this area, if you saw Neuralink by Elon Musk and you want like, I want to know more about this, you got to check it out. It's so cool. It's talking about the different actual like chips being used in this technology. It talks about some examples. My favorite. Dude, check this out. The first human cyborg, Neil Harbison, he's the co-founder of the Cyber Foundation, is colorblind. So he's installed an antenna in himself so that he can hear color.
What?
Isn't that insane? Isn't that crazy? But
yes.
But that's the kind of stuff that Paul goes over in this article, and it gives you such a great snapshot of this, again, industry and what's being done in this field. So if you're interested, definitely check it out. I got a lot of insight out of it. So with that being said, Let's hop into article one. Mind-controlled robots. So this was really interesting to me. It's coming out of EPFL. The TLDR is that they've built a system where a user's thoughts can be used to control a robot. Now, this isn't like super new. We've seen a lot of like topics like this before. We talked about when we had our Neuralink episode, we talked about an implant in a monkey that could play Pong with its mind. I think back in 2011, there was a paraplegic patient. I forgot which university it was, but they were also doing something similar where it was like using their output, the signals from their brains to translate what words they want to say. But here's why this one is interesting. So it's a two-part secret sauce that controls this robot.
And is it spicy?
I think so. I mean, I like spice, so in my perspective, it is spicy. What they really want to do here is that they took a robotic arm that they had developed some years ago at EPFL, and they wanted to take the input from the user of that's right or that's wrong for the robot to realize what it is doing is right or wrong. And I'm going to try to explain this the best I can, because what we've talked a lot about in terms of machine learning has been reinforcement learning. Right?
Yeah.
That's when the system is supposed to figure something out and you've set up rewards for it. So like if the system is supposed to be a self-driving car, every time it doesn't crash, you give it a reward. And every time it stops at a stop sign, you give it a reward. So it keeps doing things over and over again to figure out what's good and what's bad.
Yeah, I think of it like training a dog.
Exactly.
You give the dog a treat when it does something right, and that's how you teach it to do things the correct way. That's how reinforcement learning works, but with AI algorithms, right? When something's correct, you tell it what's up, and when something's wrong, you tell it what's in it's an error, right?
Right. But what they're doing here is a little different. It's called inverse reinforcement learning. And in inverse reinforcement learning, they're kind of instructing it in what the goal is. So I'm going to try to use the self-driving example again. They're saying you need to stop at the stop sign. So they're directly telling it that. But the way in which it does it could be different. So it could like be going 60 and then pressing on the brakes at the stop sign and going a little bit over. And that's an error. That's bad. Or it could just be moving super slowly and that's bad too. So it's up to the user to tell the system of that's bad, or that's good.
Okay.
What's interesting about this approach is that apparently it takes less tries to get it right. So in terms of using your mind to control the robot, it only takes 3 to 5 iterations for the robot to figure out the right path to take. So that's I wanted to lay the foundation moving forward for how this system is being approached and how it's a little bit different than the stuff that we've talked in the past.
Is the person's brain also giving that robot the goal of what to do?
I don't think so, at least not yet.
Okay, so we're just using the user's thoughts to correct
as the error signal.
Not just providing the control signal as well.
Right. Right now, it's okay. Just the error signal. And so
I guess we've seen research in the past where the brain can be used for control signals. So they're just adding an extra layer on top of that.
Right. So like going back to the example of Pong, or like to the example of saying a word and having that word be recognized. Or even if you remember with Neuralink, the demonstration they did where the implant from the pig's mind, you could see where it wanted to move its left leg. You could see spikes in it.
Yeah.
Right. So that's definitely there. And now they want to get those error thoughts. Like, apparently it's just a singular signal. So translating that was a huge challenge for them because they had to translate that error signal into the different control schematics of the robot to do something.
I mean, this is incredible to me. That's just for reference. I've worked on a project before like this where we used EEG headgear to control a game of Pong, like very similar to this monkey playing Pong with the Neuralink implant. But the only way we were able to get it to work is like it took a lot of recalibrating. And the only way we were able to get it to work is like you move your right arm to move this thing up and you move your left arm to move the paddle down. And that's not really complex enough for, you know, something as, you know, finessed as like holding a spoon and eating soup out of a bowl or something like that. And we've seen technology advance to the point where people have controlled robotic arms that do that. But I can't even imagine the amount of calibration it took and training for the person and training for the robot to get it to a point where they can coexist in a point where they're like, when I tell the robot what to do, it understands what I want and it does it properly. This seems like it is shortening that feedback loop to the point where like in 2 or 3 tries, it's getting it correct, as opposed to spending hours and hours of time of training for the person and for the robot to figure out a way for, you know, to do things properly.
You're right. And it's from my understanding, from what they were showing in the video, it's almost become like a seamless interaction. So the user, like you said, is wearing the EEG headgear, which is picking up the signals of their brain. And for this demonstration, they're using a 6-degree of freedom axis robot to avoid a glass. So it's moving fast or moving slow or moving too far away or whatever. And the user is just thinking of right or wrong, and then it finally gets it right. What's interesting is that apparently the same principle can be used for a robot that is pouring water, that is feeding you, that is doing anything. And it's so seamless, again, that it gets it right within 5 tries in the maximum, from what they reported. But that's not like, that's a feat of engineering in itself. But that wasn't the most impressive thing to me.
Wow.
The most impressive thing is the next steps. So this already, what they've accomplished can make everyone's daily lives a little bit easier, especially for patients that are paraplegic or tetraplegic. That's one of the things they mentioned. They can take care of themselves easier. The next up for them is a mind-controlled wheelchair. So,
wow.
Yeah. Like, you took controls, I took controls. That seems like an insane problem as it is. And now you have a patient that is moving, a lot of, you know, brain signals going off. You need to filter that to determine, is the wheelchair moving right in your opinion, yes or no, and feed it into the wheelchair in real time and get it to course correct. So that's the next thing that they're tackling with the same idea and principles that they've established here.
I mean, this is like taking it from a level where I'm like, yes, I understand this biomedical engineering. Like, yes, I've done this before. Like, wow, this is impressive. And now I'm like, we're living in a sci-fi movie.
Right.
Just to think about, like, when you're engineering or designing a control system, right, you have to focus on the consequences of the bad outcome, right? The consequences of a bad outcome for a robotic arm, you know, pouring a glass of water. Like, it sucks that it spills the glass of water in the patient, and you don't want to do that tons of times because it's really, really frustrating to be, you know, splashed with water every single time you try to drink out of a cup. But all in all, the consequences of that are pretty low.
It's like minimal.
Just wet, change your clothes, whatever. But a mind-controlled wheelchair, if they feel confident enough to apply this technology there, this is them saying that they have enough confidence in the control system that this wheelchair can drive around controlled by the mind and not crash and kill the person, or not crash and kill someone else, or injure someone else, or damage things. I mean, this is, you know, when you see technology get deployed in higher risk situations, it means that they have higher control and higher confidence in their ability to execute.
Absolutely. And what I loved about this is that there's two different labs at EPFL that's actually like working on this research. One of them is the Brain Machine Interface Laboratory. So again, that those are the folks looking at the brain to signal translation side. Mm-hmm. And then you have the Learning Algorithms and Systems Laboratory. So that's the algorithm that's going to work with the robotic system or the wheelchair to make everything work together.
Yeah, so I've never really thought about, you know, machine learning being used in this type of application, but it's like a whole new world for me, just opening my mind around just thinking about how many hours we spent in this project team trying to get, you know, so just to control a Pong paddle going up and down. And only one person in our group could do it successfully. And, you know, all those hours spent into that, and then trying to do something as complex as driving a wheelchair using your mind, and that they feel confident to do that. And the key that's unlocking it is using machine learning with inverse reinforcement learning to figure it out.
You know, it's a testament to how far we've come with technology and what a great spot we are in right now for all these amazing research and advancements that we're seeing. And this one actually hits home for me because I have a loved one who has spinal cord injury. So I could see how this technology could directly impact and make their lives better. So yeah. In this realm, I'm super excited about this, dude. And if we've come, you know, when, I don't know when you did this project, imagine how far we've come in the past couple of years, how much further we're going to go in the next few.
Yeah. I mean, we've gone from like students playing Pong with an EEG headset to monkey playing Pong with a Neuralink implant to like people being able to regain their independence to move around and to do actions around the house and only have to use their brain to do it. And in a way that's not frustrating to them. The robot understands it in only a few tries. I mean, this sounds like where technology is becoming mature enough in the space where it can truly start to impact some people's lives and improve it.
Absolutely.
Well, I'm going to jump us into our second article here. And I'm afraid it doesn't have the same profound impact on people just yet, but let's jump into it and see what we're talking about here. You know, we're talking about huge implications of mind-controlled wheelchairs. Now let's get down really, really small. We're talking about bug robots, really, really small bug robots from MIT. Just some background. When it comes to robots, I say size matters. And in terms of bug robots, bigger isn't always better, right? I mean, imagine some of the applications you want to use a swarm of insect-sized robots for. They talk about if we somehow have bees that go extinct, you want to go pollinate a field. You don't want things that are the size of an airplane flying around trying to pollinate a field. You know, bees are tiny for a reason. It's so that they can fit in the flowers without damaging it and go on and pollinate the next one. And also searching rubble for survivors. So they want to make tiny little insect type drones that can fly around in the rubble of a collapsed building or something after an earthquake and look for survivors in there. And in this case, size matters, but it's because smaller is better, not bigger.
So you got my attention for sure, but I'm not sure if you know this, but you just explained the start of a Black Mirror episode, like an actual Black Mirror episode.
Yeah, yeah. So I am aware of this.
I'm interested to see where you're going to go with it, but I'm open. I'm open to it.
Well, this team from MIT, their whole focus is on trying to make these bug robots come to life. And, okay, you know, there are, I'm not sure of what their eventual intentions are of it. I assume it's good. These are, you know, scientists trying to improve the world. I don't think they're going to, you know, create surveillance drones that are actually bees, or bees that are actually surveillance drones. But, you know, when they talk about the shortage of bees that we might have, you know, we can't save our bees. We don't know exactly why they're dying. And we know that it is a key, their pollination, to agriculture that sustains life on Earth.
Absolutely.
So as a contingency plan, these guys are like, let's make some bug robots that are small enough that we can pollinate plants if we need to.
Well, sorry, real quick note. A fun fact I heard about just how crucial these bees are and how we're hurting as a result of their diminishing population. There's actual like bee farmers, I guess, that have to truck out their bees from the East Coast to the West Coast during different periods of time to get the bees to pollinate because those regions don't have the bees they need anymore.
Yeah,
so
that's,
we're like literally moving bees around the country to make our produce grow that we depend on.
And I can only imagine that will continue to get worse in the next few years. So I'm hoping these bug robot folks and other scientists are working on this problem. But what they're saying is traditional rigid actuators, like we're talking like a motor with an axle, those aren't durable enough at the small size that you need to make a flying bug robot to actually work over an extended period of time. They're saying a traditional rigid actuator can only flap the wings of a bee for a few seconds before it dies out. So what's the solution here? If you want to make something that small, they look at biology. And that this is where the bio-inspired part of this engineering solution, they've created artificial muscles. That's the actuator that's powering these wings. It's just layered levels or layered slices of thin electrode and then elastic. And they polarize the electrodes, one positive, one negative, and it tightens the elastic together. And that strain is used just like in a muscle when electrical impulses are applied to your muscle to tighten them, to actuate the wings. So there's just pulses of electricity on and off is what's flapping the wing. And they have elastic layers in between those electrodes that's squishing. And that mechanical strain in that elastic is what's pulling the wing and flapping it.
Got it.
Just like a muscle, you know, the impulse is applied from your brain, the electricity goes through your nerves to your muscles, and that electricity there causes your muscles to tighten. That's what they're trying to do here, but with really, really, really small artificial muscles. These, one, typically require really high voltages to operate. That's challenging. And they also, the smaller they get, the less reliable they get. So imagine if you're trying to make something that's really thin, you know, one piece of dust or one little bubble, that defect matters a lot as opposed to when you have a larger one.
That makes sense.
That the electricity can pass through that or the elastic won't tear because of that. So they basically reinvented the entire fabrication process for these artificial muscles, which for them, these are experts at MIT that have done this before, that have had research at the forefront. They made a 6-layer muscle that, you know, was considered to be state of the art at the time. And they're saying that's still not good enough for us to make tiny robots. So they reinvented their entire fabrication process through a bunch of trials to reduce the required voltage and to reduce the thickness of this thing so that it can be used in small applications. So I'm not going to go into everything that they did. If you want to check that out and you're a material science geek, like Verboden and I are, you can check out this article. It's going to be linked in the show notes. But this is going to sound like a lot of the stuff that we read about or did in our nanomaterials fabrication lab for about. They rehauled their spin coating process, their vacuum sealing process, the concentration of carbon nanotubes in their electrode formula, their curing times in the oven, their curing times out of the oven, curing in a vacuum, curing outside of a vacuum. And they're doing all of this in a clean room so that there's no dust.
It's like basically a trip down memory lane, dude. Like
it is a trip down memory lane for us. And for folks that aren't involved with all these processes, you can basically say that they made this thing before that was state of the art. And then they put that on steroids and, you know, looked at every single part of their fabrication process, scrutinized all of it to reduce all the parts of error, to optimize every single step along the way. And so remember I said they made a relatively thick 6-layer electrode that required a lot of electricity to operate. They created, this time, one that was thinner, but had 20 layers involved of alternating elastic and electrode, which is, you know, more like the muscle. The muscles are fibrous in our body. It's made of layers. And so they tested this against their previous state-of-the-art 6-layer one, as well as the smallest and, you know, best and brightest state-of-the-art rigid actuators. Like, that's what I was talking about, motors and axles.
Right.
And their results were they were able to make a robot that was 0.63 grams. That's 1/4 the weight of a penny in the US. So think about how light and small this thing is. The soft actuator robot, you know, when they installed their previous actuator muscle, it could barely fly. It could fly for a few seconds and kind of hover off the ground. This one could hover with extreme control. So they could tell it where to go and then it would hover there in that position for over 20 seconds. And that's the longest flight ever by a robot under 1 gram. And that includes all type of actuators that have been created to date. So
now what was the 20-second flight time constrained by the energy source or the actuator lifespan?
It was constrained by the actuator lifespan. So there's more still that they need to dig into to figure this out. But basically what they figured out is a quantum leap in terms of getting something to function. I mean, imagine the difference between a tiny bug robot that you know, looks like its wings are broken. It's basically flapping around and it can barely fly, or it kind of hovers off the ground and it can't fly for an extended period of time, versus something that can fly around for 20 seconds and you can have extreme control over it. I only imagine as they continue to dive deeper into this, they'll probably get something that can fly around for minutes, and then they'll talk about hours. And, you know, this is just one step along the way. 20 seconds doesn't sound like a lot, but it is a lot compared to what they had before, which is something that could barely fly at all.
It's those, you know, giant baby steps that get us to where we need to go. And this is one of those giant baby steps. That's incredible. Yeah,
and also, one of the things we talk about is, you know, when we're talking about drones and stuff like that, the weight is really, really important. The amount that it's able to lift in proportion to the weight of the robot or the drone itself. And so I was thinking, like, well, this one, if they've, you know, made it this light and they've made it this small, and it's able to fly for 20 seconds, is it just not going to be able to fly at all when you add something on there, like an attachment to help it pollinate, right, or a camera to help look for people in the rubble? They said
to spy on people.
This thing, I hope not. This thing can effectively lift things over 3 times its weight and still able able to fly under real control. So it's not like they're tapping out the lift to weight ratio of where this thing is, you know, this thing's potential. They still have a lot of room and 3 times the amount of weight to add on and packages and attachments and stuff if they want to, before they reach what I would call like the physics limit of what they're trying to do. So the amount of
maximum lift
that this thing is able to generate versus the amount of weight that it's able to carry.
Okay. And like, so like this feat of engineering is mainly for like these bug robots right now, right?
Yeah, that's their biggest focus. And
but these actuators, they could be used for any application that requires high RPM, right?
Exactly. And that's actually what this team specializes in. As some of the research here, the researchers, they focus on small robotics. But most of the team is actually focused on soft robotics. And that's them using the elastic actuators as opposed to a hard, rigid actuator. And they're saying, you know, this fundamental unlock of what we've done for bug robots, we can use this to create artificial muscles that are much stronger, require less power, and last a lot longer for all types of applications. So what they've really done, you know, I would call it the secret sauce of what they've developed here, is they, from the ground up, remember, they reinvented their part of the fabrication process. They found a way, you know, from the ground up to create a new artificial muscle that works a lot better than the ones that we've seen before, requires a lot less power, lasts a lot longer, and is also, you know, free of all the manufacturing defects that we've seen so far.
Right. Wow. No, I think you downplayed this article a little bit when you first started. This is really cool, dude. This is a pretty big deal.
I didn't mean to downplay it. I think what we were looking at before has a lot of immediate impact. And this bug robot here is like, we're opening, I wouldn't call it a can of worms, I'd call it like a can of awesomeness. MIT's just opened a can of awesomeness in terms of creating artificial muscles. And they're doing it for bug robots now. I'd love to see where they apply it in the future. And I'd also love to see them improve and iterate until they get to a point where, you know, hopefully all of our produce isn't screwed if the bees die off and we have a way to pollinate the fields without killing all of our produce as well.
For sure. You know, secret sauce, can of awesomeness. You're all about these wonderful words.
I'm coming out here with the punch phrases.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
You really are. No, it's great. We got to make like a swag line out of these. I'd wear
either
a hat.
Swag line
can
or
of
like
awesome.
A glossary to understand what I'm saying.
You know, that we should preface every episode with common terms used in these episodes. All right, everyone. I feel like that's a pretty good spot to end this episode on. Thank you for listening. And if you're not hip, Spotify actually has a reviewing portion to podcasts now.
And they haven't until a few weeks ago.
Right. So we would really appreciate it if you could direct your energy there. That's, you know, it helps us be discovered by other people like you that would enjoy tech topics, and it helps the podcast grow. So if you could take a second, maybe even message your friend, be like, hey, we love the Next Byte podcast. We should leave a review about how much we love it. Or maybe, you know, you hate it, but you're still listening. So please leave a review.
Yeah. And I'd like to say, similarly to the way we shouted out everyone that gave us a review on Apple Podcasts, we love our Spotify people just as much. Actually, Farbode and I are both Spotify listeners. So we're right there with you, folks. Hop over to Spotify, give us a review, and if you take a screenshot of it and send it to us, we'd love to shout you out in the pod as well. The people that give us reviews, you know, you are probably one of the biggest ways that we've been able to grow, and be able to reach the number of people that we have so far. So we'd really appreciate it if you can do that for us on Spotify. The review system is new. Everyone that's been asking how to help since you're on Spotify, this is your way. This is your time to shine. Now, Spotify, give us a review. We really appreciate it a lot. And we'll see you in the next episode.
Peace. That's all for today. The Next Bite podcast is produced by Weavolver. And to learn more about the topics we discussed today, visit weavolver.com. If you enjoy this episode, please review and subscribe via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or one of your favorite platforms. I'm Forbode.
And I'm Daniel.
Thank you for listening, and we'll see you in the next episode.